It is my great pleasure to introduce Luis Jacob, artist, curator, and writer based in Toronto. As an artist, he's had several solo presentations in German institutions, so maybe known to a few of you as well, and perhaps particularly through his work shown at Documenta in 2012. And he's also curated several shows. I just mentioned the one that I've seen, Funk Aesthetics, in 2010 in the Justin Barnicke Gallery in Toronto. And I'd like to invite Luis Jacob to the stage. Form Follows Fiction, Cases of Mistaken Identity in Central Canadian Art. Thanks, Luis.
All right. Let us begin with a poem. The Double Voice by Margaret Atwood. Two voices took turns using my eyes. One had manners, painted in watercolors, used hushed tones when speaking of mountains or Niagara Falls, composed uplifting verse, and expended sentiment upon the poor. The other voice had other knowledge, that men sweat always and drink often, that pigs are pigs, but must be eaten anyway, that unborn babies fester like wounds in the body, that there's nothing to be done about mosquitoes. One saw through my bleared and gradually bleaching eyes red leaves, the rituals of seasons and rivers. The other found a dead dog, jubilant with maggots, half buried among the sweet peas. Margaret Atwood wrote The Double Voice as part of her cycle of poems titled The Journals of Susanna Moody, first published by Oxford University Press Canada in 1970. In that book, Atwood adopted the voice of Susanna Moody, an English woman who, in 1832, migrated to the British colony of Upper Canada, today the province of Ontario, where I live. Moody had written about her experiences as a settler in her two books, Roughing It in the Bush, or Life in Canada, published in 1852, and Life in the Clearings versus the Bush, published in the following year. At one level, Atwood's idea of the double voice suggests the divided worldview of the British settler in North America, trying to come to terms with a universe radically different from the one of her birth. Atwood once wrote that the Canadian pioneer is a square man in a round hole. He faces the problem of trying to fit a straight line into a curved space. From this perspective, the doubleness of the poem describes the split reality of painting watercolors while surrounded by mosquitoes. Moody's unsettled life in Upper Canada, unsettled to the extent that her life in the colony is lived in mismatched relation to expectations originating in the distant imperial center where she grew up. At another level, Atwood's double voice points to the dual utterance at play in the entire cycle of poems. In the book's afterword, she wrote, "I suppose many of these poems were suggested by Mrs. Moody's books, though it was not her conscious voice, but the other voice running like a counterpoint through her work that made the most impression on me." Atwood's voice as an author appears in an act of ventriloquism, projected through the voice of Susanna Moody, who was herself also an author. Atwood's poems are thus doubly inscribed. They emanate from the conscious, documented voice of a real historical figure from the 1850s, and they are imagined as that other contrapuntal voice of a fictional character of Atwood's creative interpretation. And I'm interested in the alternating presence in Atwood's poem of these two aspects of double voicing. So on the one hand, we have the split reality of the settler's life in the colony or periphery. And on the other hand, there is the double inscription in the act of authorial ventriloquism. In the first case, doubleness stems from the idea that Moody's new home, with its mountains and waterfalls, ought to be a splendid place for painting watercolors, were not for the fact that mosquitoes also live there. A place fails to coincide with the image that colonial desires assumes the landscape must conform to. To settle the land is to become unsettled by it. In the second case, doubleness arises from the idea that authors ought to develop their voices organically from the immediacy of their own practice. Were it not the case that an author like Atwood develops her voice artificially, a text is mediated through another author's text. And voice is a matter of playing with surrogates and impersonating them. Atwood's poetic insight lies, I believe, in the recognition of the rhythmic nature of this doubleness. Two voices took turns using my eyes. The Journals of Susanna Moody was published at a fertile moment of cultural nationalism in the literary scene of Toronto during the early 1970s. One of the institutional catalysts of this scene was the House of Anansi, a small press publisher of books that attempted to describe Canadian culture as seen from Toronto through an anti-imperialist lens. Margaret Atwood was a key contributor. In her book, Survival, A Thematic Guide to Canadian Literature, published by House of Anansi in 1972, Atwood returned to the writings of Susanna Moody and what she called her double-minded attitude towards Canada. Atwood framed Moody's writings in the context of aesthetic ideas of her time. Towards the middle of the 19th century, Atwood wrote, English immigrants were safely in Canada, their heads filled with diluted Burke and Wordsworth, encountering lots and lots of nature. If Wordsworth was right, Canada ought to have been the great good place. Complaining about the bogs and mosquitoes must have been like criticizing the authority of the Bible. According to Atwood, an imagination such as Moody's, filled as it was with Edmund Burke's and William Wordsworth's ideas on the sublime, would develop a conflicted relationship to the natural environment of her new home. The imagination would experience what Atwood described as a tension between what you were officially supposed to feel and what you actually encountered when you got there. She wrote, "In Roughing It in the Bush, Mrs. Moody's determination to preserve her Wordsworthian faith collides with the difficulty she has in doing so when nature fails time and time again to come through for her. Two emotions, faith in the Divine Mother and a feeling of hopeless imprisonment, follow each other on the pages of Moody's writings without break or explanation. Moody copes with the contradiction by dividing nature in two, reserving the splendid adjectives and the Divine Mother attributes for the half that she approves of, and failing to account for the hostile activities of the other half. Again and again, we find her gazing at the sublime natural goings-on in the misty distance, sunsets, mountains, spectacular views, only to be brought up short by disagreeable things in her immediate foreground, such as bugs, swamps, tree roots, and other immigrants." So, according to Atwood, Moody's double-minded attitude consists in this: a discrepancy between the unaccounted foreground of the world around her that is eclipsed by the splendid background of the world as projected to her from elsewhere. The projection tells Moody that her new home ought to take the form of the sublime in nature. But since the world she actually experiences fits this projection only intermittently, then she must leave outside of her written account the aspects of her experience that do not fit the picture. The result is a strange gestalt phenomenon, a conflicted figure-ground relationship. The ground, which normally contextualizes a figure and allows the figure to appear, the background now undermines the figure. We can even say, ironically, that the figure in Canada appears precisely in the event of being undermined. The foreground of the world where Moody lives remains unaccounted for in the conscious dimension of her writing. It can appear only in the form of an other voice, in another author's interpretive act of ventriloquism. Atwood's poem adopts and performs double-mindedness. Her writing embodies double-mindedness as something both to historicize and to reflect upon. So what does this strange gestalt look like to a Peruvian settler in Canada, such as myself, living in Toronto today in the early part of the 21st century? A few years ago, I had finished teaching a series of courses at the University of Toronto and the University of Guelph. As a sessional teacher, I was struck by how fascinated my students seemed to be by what they heard was happening in places like Berlin, London, and New York, and simultaneously by how very little they knew about what was happening in their own backyards. This predicament in the classroom reminded me of Penny Cousineau-Levin's book, Faking Death, Canadian Art Photography and the Canadian Imagination. In it, she described talking to her students at a photographic history course that she was teaching in Montreal, students who, as she noted, were themselves to become the next generation of Canadian photographers. She wrote, "When shown Canadian photographs alongside those made in Britain, the United States, and elsewhere, whether documentary photographs or portraits or landscapes, the almost universal response of these students was that they could see nothing in these images, that there was nothing there. The fact that these students had absolutely no sense of the significance of the products of their own people, and hence, by extrapolation of their own artistic work, that they could look forward only to making images they themselves would view as valueless and that would fall invisible into a critical void, all of this was enough to make me call into question what I was doing as a teacher." So her students, as well as my own, were inquisitive and invested in the work of fellow artists, but only as long as those artists represented people, places, and events that did not reflect the realities that these students experienced directly in their own lives. It seemed to me that for these students, reality was divided into the splendid background of images projected to them from the world's artistic capitals, and the unaccounted foreground of life around them. Foreground was eclipsed by background and could appear only as nothing in a case of mistaken identity. Real life was elsewhere. The foreground of bugs, swamps, tree roots, and other immigrants that we cannot account for seems to haunt us today, more than 150 years after Susanna Moody's time. This predicament of the split, substitute reality of the imperialized imagination informs my curatorial work as an artist and my artistic work as a curator in Toronto. Let us begin, then, by supposing that this painting is, in fact, a theatrical stage set. It contains an arrangement of props for the kind of scenario that we have been calling a double-minded attitude. Like Velázquez's Las Meninas, it depicts an uncanny moment. The completed painting presents itself in the act of being painted. In order to do this, the artist has folded the composition in two, with each half subdivided again in two, creating a system of gaps and a network of reciprocities and correspondences that is complex to the point of vertigo. On the right-hand side, we observe two objects grouped together on a white wall. A shard of broken mirror catches the reflection of the painter, Fred Hagen, who looks intently at his own image. The broken mirror serves as support for displaying a memento, a clipped reproduction of the painting The West Wind of 1917 by Tom Thompson, an iconic work that is easily recognizable to lovers of Canadian art. So the right-hand side of the painting juxtaposes two kinds of images corresponding to two kinds of presence. The fleeting immediacy of the here-and-now reflection in the mirror and the mass media reproduction of an artwork from the National Canon of Art History. On the left-hand side of the painting, we witness a second instance of reflection and reproduction that reproduces and reflects the first one. The real canvas immediately before us in the museum makes a mise-en-abîme appearance inside itself as a projection of a painting within a painting. The second fictional canvas is propped on an easel in the artist's studio. It is surrounded by the stool on which the artist paints, his palette of still malleable pigments, a framed artwork displayed on the wall in a corner of the studio, and an assembly of completed works leaning one upon the other on the floor in an area of improvised storage behind the door. The fictional painting on the easel is accompanied, in other words, by figures representing the life cycle of the real painting. This life cycle constitutes the painting's own existence as a work of art, from raw artistic material in a state of potential to the blooming moment of exhibition and display, and finally to its fate in storage and possibly neglect, the critical void that Cousineau Levine warned us about. In Fred Hagen's Canadian painting of 1948, that fictional canvas on the easel is responsible for staging a tableau vivant in which the real canvas is implicated and enlisted to hold the pose of its own past and its own possible futures. These moments of the artwork's life cycle are negated, but never transcended by the painting's here and now presence before us in the museum. The mirror reflection appears less sharply in the fictional painting, less clearly defined than in the real one. The face in that mirror is suspended in a state of incipiency that is grotesque, like something unborn, or else is jubilant in its formlessness. And the clipped piece of paper appears there too in the fictional canvas, again supported by a fictional mirror on the wall. But the paper is now nearly blank. It depicts nothing, a blind eye or a vacant lot. That fictional piece of paper renders Thompson's own iconic artwork at a moment prior to its recruitment within the lineage of the national artistic canon. Its face, if we can call it that, is neither grotesque nor jubilant, but the absence that it registers is ambiguous. Its blankness, uninhabited like the new world of the colonial imagination, is both a kind of placeholder for experiences yet to be accounted for, as well as an erasure of things ignored and unrecognized. It is now worth taking a detour from Fred Hagen's Canadian painting to consider Tom Thompson's The West Wind, a painting that has accrued a very diverse body of discourse since the time of its creation 100 years ago in the shack of the studio building in Toronto. The 1990 catalog of the Art Gallery of Ontario's collection, of which the Thompson painting is an important part, had this to say. There are very few more widely recognizable and frequently reproduced icons of Canadian art than the West Wind. The artist, Lauren Harris, recalled in 1954 that he and Thompson had painted together in an old clearing at the south end of the Cochon Lakes, in the remote northeastern sector of Algonquin Park. Harris vividly described the violent spring thunderstorm that had whipped the dark blue-gray waters of the lake into sudden white caps. Tom and I took shelter in an abandoned lumber shack. Then Tom looked out, became excited by the drama of the scene, grabbed his sketchbox, ran out into the gale, squatted behind the big stump, and commenced to paint in a fury. So according to this description, the painting is the result of artistic fury aroused by a storm in Algonquin Park. More recently, David Silcox has described the painting in this way. The twisted trunk and branches show age and perseverance and bravery against the elements. The painting may also reflect Thompson's state of mind. He painted this canvas while in Europe the First World War was raging, a cataclysmic event in which many of his friends were involved. So in this description, the painting continues to depict a storm, but this is as much a world historical storm as it is a natural one. Artistic fury is replaced by a metaphor of perseverance in the face of a war of empires, a European war in which Canada, then part of the British Empire, was necessarily embroiled. In 1974, Barry Lord again identified the theme of perseverance in the painting, but placed this theme on a different register. The tree in the wind is a symbol of the tenacious grasp on the land and on life that our nation has maintained. In the struggle to build our nation under the domination of a succession of the world's leading imperial powers, and he means those of France and England and the United States, we have had to dig in and hold on to become and remain who we are. This is clearly a national bourgeois symbol of our nation. To a class that is always being tempted to sell out, it represents the ideal of steadfastness. As an image of heroic endurance, therefore, the West Wind reflects both the aspirations and the limitations of the national bourgeoisie itself. In 1977, Harold Town and David Silcox once again identified the theme of heroic endurance, but this time they did so in order to deflate it. So they wrote, "It is our emblem tree, our token tree, and the question is why? First, because it is alone, and despite a paramount position in the composition formed as a commanding open arabesque, it allows an easy, faceted entry into the windswept distance. Thompson's pine gives us the comfort of a tree plus a sense of decoration. It is easily acquired firewood that we could knock down without much trouble. Not a giant redwood, 10 days' work with an axe, but a magnified bonsai. The west wind reminds us of a day at the cottage that everyone dreads and how a pine like Thompson's makes it tolerable." Here, Lord's prior description of the struggle for survival against the comprador class that will sell out the nation's resources to the demands of empire is provocatively replaced by a bonsai tree, decorative and pleasing to look through. Both the Wordsworthian sublime and the myth of Canada's natural environment are rendered ironic by city dwellers for whom awe-inspiring nature is little more than a stormy day at the cottage. Today, the West Wind is on view in a special room at the Art Gallery of Ontario. The interpretive text on the walls contextualize its depiction of Algonquin Park in terms of national myths and contemporary First Nations land claims. The text reads, "This work has acquired iconic status over time, interpreted by many critics as a bold statement of national identity, resiliency, and belonging in nature. It is often used to reinforce ideas about Canadian identity and the Canadian landscape. For many, Algonquin Park embodies a pure and untouched ideal of wilderness. But even in Thompson's time, its landscape had been dramatically reshaped by colonialism, industry, and wildlife management. Large sections of the park had been clear-cut by the logging industry, and it was a popular tourist site easily accessible by rail. The park is also at the heart of a territory of deep significance to a number of First Nations, and land claim negotiations are ongoing today." I mean, this is amazing. I've never seen a museum actually contextualize an artwork in terms of contemporary First Nations land claims. It's quite astonishing and an amazing step for museum discourse in Canada. Today, the West Wind is displayed alongside Michael Belmore's Breadth of 2014. The sculpture is made of raku-fired clay and copper leaf and depicts a young deer that has been run over by a vehicle. In North America, we would call this deer roadkill, a casualty of the violent encounter between the bush and the clearing. Exhibited together, the twisted body of the sculpture seems to correspond with the arabesque shapes of the painting. This curatorial gesture connects two artworks that were created a century apart, allowing each to take turns speaking through the other. The pose of the deer's body suggests a violent accident. but the lines of copper that fragment it indicate something else. The body has been carefully cut like a butchered animal or a landscape sectioned by property lines. These lines, which glow in the sculpture like the embers of an almost extinguished fire, have been traced in copper, an important mineral resource both for the Algonquin people of Lake Superior and for the colonial government. Today, the Algonquin people and the government of Ontario are engaged in a land claim negotiation over the Algonquin traditional territory, an area of over 9 million acres that includes Canada's National Capital Region, all of Renfrew County, and most of Algonquin Provincial Park, where the original sketch for the West Wind was painted. This body of discourse that orbits around Tom Thompson's artwork is condensed in the printed memento beside the mirror in Fred Hagen's painting. While Thompson's work has become an emblematic part of the national tradition, Hagen's own work is presently at risk of being forgotten. It is tempting, perhaps, to read the memento as an expression of Hagen's desire for inscription into the national artistic canon. In this context, we might detect in Canadian painting a story of canonical continuity. The temptation is real. In the beginning, we might hear it say, Canadian art was nothing but a blank canvas, since it lacked an autonomous artistic culture not beholden to European models. Then came Tom Thompson, an artist whose tragically brief but blazing career inspired a group of painters to develop a new artistic language for representing the distinctive features of the Canadian landscape. His work prepared the ground for future generations of artists who would further develop a truly national, no longer colonial, culture. This narrative, which begins in the clearing of cultural vacancy and ends in the cultivated garden, is the origin myth of the visual arts in English Canada. Like Maurice Denis's Hommage to Cézanne of 1900, so Fred Hagen's Canadian painting is plausible to us as an homage to Tom Thompson's seminal accomplishment and as a story devoted to the continuity of the national tradition. Such an interpretation is reasonable if we assume that Canada is a normal nation, like France, for example. But Canada is not a normal nation. As Menahem Blondheim observed in 2007, Canada represents a mirror image of the normal national state. Given its vast and fragmented expanse, it is a country divided by a common geography. Given its novelty and demographic heterogeneity, its unity is threatened rather than sustained by memory and history. These ideas are worth repeating. A common geography, normally what unites a country, is precisely what in Canada divides it. Memory and history, normally enlisted to sustain a sense of unity, serve in Canada to threaten unity. I know that these ideas are counterintuitive, and they are hard to digest, even where I live. Margaret Atwood once observed that Canada is an unknown territory for the people who live in it. Her efforts, as well as that of other authors associated with House of Anansi, challenge me to discern within the painting's invocation of the nation other voices running through it, to see a nation constituted as much by blank misrecognition as by identity, by erasure as by interpretive vertigo, by double-mindedness as by political projects of assimilation and unification. The project of assimilation does exist in Canada as elsewhere. It has created catastrophes like the Canadian Indian residential school system, acknowledged by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission last year as a tool of cultural genocide that formally came to an end only in 1996, but whose consequences we live with today. Canadian painting invokes for me the work of other artists in the city of Toronto where I live, allowing these works to resonate across time. From Christian Flug's Interior at Night of 1965, with its two dolls looking out through an opening that is both transparent window and reflective mirror, to Joyce Wieland and Hollis Frampton's collaborative film A and B in Ontario of 1967, with its two artists, one Canadian, one from the US, mirroring each other with their film cameras in a game of hide and seek through the streets of Toronto. To Michael Snow's Authorization of 1969, with its time-warping sequence of photographs of a mirror taped to the self-same mirror brick by brick, eventually eclipsing the camera's reflection with photographs of photographs. To General Idea's double mirror video, A Borderline Case of 1971, with its group self-portrait presented as a dream of a community communicating with itself through its own self-mediation. And from Jeff Thomas's Polyphonic Ventriloquism in Culture Revolution, Toronto, Ontario, 1984, a photograph of the artist's son, Bear, who wears a baseball cap emblazoned with Edward Curtis's portrait from 1910 of the Cheyenne leader Two Moons. Edward Curtis's work is a source of so many contemporary stereotypes. As Bear poses for his dad's camera on Queen Street in Toronto. To Joanne Todd's The Magic of Sao Paulo of 1985, a painting that impersonates the front cover design of C magazine, preparing itself for reproduction in anticipation of its hoped for recruitment into the international biennial circuit. To John Sasaki's photograph, Microbes Swabbed from a Palette Used by Tom Thompson of 2012, a photograph perhaps of the bugs and swamps that live today in Thompson's artistic tools. To Rula Parteniu's sculpture, Doppelkopf, of 2013, with its paired collection of facsimiles of office supplies, each side mirroring what is eclipsed in the other. Fred Hagen's painting allows me to connect these dots. It's quite plausible that in doing so, it sets the stage for a narrative of artistic lineage and canonical continuity. But I suspect that several elements in the painting disrupt this possibility. The brokenness of the mirror, the fold in the painting that engages and implicates the viewer, its play of figure-ground relationships, its embrace of both the jubilant and the grotesque, its palpable sense of orphanhood, and the fact that the meta-fictional painting depicted inside the fictional painting within the painting is rendered not as a blank canvas, not as a blank emptiness, but as an always already divided enigma at the heart of purported beginnings. Hagen's work is almost completely forgotten today, and it lies in wait in a critical void. It is perhaps for this reason that it dares me to imagine identities that are sustained by alternating between memory and oblivion, continuity and vertigo, authorship and ventriloquism, community and orphanhood, authenticity and stereotype, canon formation, and the hallucinatory refractions of mirror images and colliding projections. In the painting, I can glimpse a figure that, far from being grounded in unity, far from being undermined by rupture, is sustained in tension between these poles. We end at a perfect place to start by quoting from Northrop Frye's book, The Bush Garden, Essays on the Canadian Imagination, published by House of Anansi in 1971. He wrote, "The tension between the political sense of unity and the imaginative sense of locality is the essence of whatever the word Canadian means." I repeat, the word Canadian refers, for Frye, neither to a political sense of national unity, nor to a cultural sense of regional specificity, each place conceived in isolation. Canadian is what you get only in the tension that arises when different voices take turns using our eyes. Thanks.